Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jean Valentine. Jean Valentine was born in Chicago, earned her B.A. from Radcliffe College, and has lived most of her life in New York City. She won the Yale Younger Poets Award for her first book, Dream Barker, in 1965. She is the author of 8 other books of poetry, including most recently Growing Darkness, Growing Light in 1997, The River at Wolf in 1992, and her newest book, The Cradle of the Real Life, published by Wesleyan in 2000. Jean Valentine also has an upcoming book entitled Door in the Mountain, New and Collected Poems, due out in fall 2004, also by Wesleyan. She has received a Guggenheim Fellowship and awards from the NEA, the Bunting Institute, the Rockefeller Foundation, the New York Council for the Arts, and the New York Foundation for the Arts, as well as the Maurice English Prize, the Teasdale Poetry Prize, and the Poetry Society of America's Shelley's Memorial Prize in the year 2000. She teaches at Sarah Lawrence College, the Graduate Writing Program of New York University, Columbia University, and the 92nd Street Y. Welcome, Jean. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. We're excited to have you here, and you're going to begin with The Cradle of the Real Life poems.
Okay. Yeah, I'll read some poems from that last book. The first poem I'll read is called The Pen. The sandy road, the bright green 2-inch lizard, little light on the road, the pen that writes by itself, the mist that blows by through itself, the gourd I drink from in my sleep that also drinks from me. Who taught me to know instead of not to know? And this pen, its thought, lying on the thought of the table, a bow lying across the strings, not moving, held. Then I'll read an elegy I wrote for Jane Kenyon, who was, as you know, probably married to the poet Donald Hall, so they're both mentioned in this poem. Jane died young. Jane is big with death, dawn sad and kind. Jane, though she's dying, is full of mind. We talk about the table, the little walnut one, how it's like Emily Dickinson's. But Don says no. Dickinson's was made of iron. No, said Jane, of flesh. This one is called Mare and Newborn Foal, and it's a mare talking to her little foal. When you die, there are bales of hay heaped high in space. Meanwhile, with my tongue, I draw the black straw out of you. Meanwhile, with your tongue, you draw the black straw out of me. This one is an elegy I wrote for a friend named Rodney. I wrote 2 others in an earlier book, and this is the 3rd one, Rodney Dying. I vacuumed your bedroom, 1 gray sock, got sucked up, it was gone. Sock you wore on your warm foot, walked places in, turned, walked back, took off your heavy shoes and socks, and swam. And this next one I'll read is called Labrador. It's meaning the Labrador dog. Crossing a fenced-off railroad track, holes in the fence, carrying a dog, my journey. I drop him. He's heavy. I can't pick him up. He puts his foot in a trap, chained to the track, a trap Yes, but that dog won't chew his foot off. He's barking at himself. He won't let me near. I left him. So then I'll read this one called 1945, which is about my father in the Pacific during World War II. And at the end of the war, 1945, he came back. He was working on a carrier, an aircraft carrier, working with the pilots who were much younger. He was in his 30s. They were 19 or 20. And sometimes they would go off on missions and then not come back because they were killed. And they called him Pop. And when he came back, he had post-traumatic stress syndrome. So that was very hard for him and for our family. 1945. A year in the Pacific, watching his pilots not come back to the ship. They were 19, 20. They called him Pop. We lived for the day he came back. The day he came back, he raged like Achilles. The day, the year, years. We flew off, one off a bridge, one into a book, one a note into a bottle. We never came back. Oh, my dead father. And he says, ah, Jeannie, you're still in words. This is one actually called Radio. So read it on the radio. It's hearing a poetry reading on NPR of a poet who had died years before when I was young. I heard your voice on the radio, 30 years dead, and got across the kitchen to get next to you. Breath and breath, two horses. But it wasn't you back then. I was liquid too. It was my life. I wanted to be you, amount to something. Be the other, the ready stone, prayer rag tied to a wire fence, a branch.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jean Valentine, reading from her book, The Cradle of the Real Life. Jean, I wanted to, if you'd let me read a short quote from Adrienne Rich talking about your work.
Sure.
And then ask you something. So this is Adrienne Rich talking. Looking into a Jean Valentine poem is like looking into a lake. You can see your own outline and the shapes of the upper world reflected among rocks, underwater life, glint of lost bottles, drifted leaves. The known and familiar become one with the mysterious and half-wild at the place where consciousness and the subliminal meet. This is a poetry of the highest order because it lets us into spaces and meanings we couldn't approach in any other way. So what I wanted to ask you is, you know, I love the way that your poems sort of let us enter them on our own, and it's almost as if the poems themselves have let things go, like you've let things go, like words, sentences, things in the poems, so that we're left with our own sentences, our own internal world, and that we meet sort of our own world on the page or something. Is that what you're imagining with your work, or am I describing something that you think that your work is doing? Or?
Well, that would be wonderful if that's what my work was doing. I love that description, and I, of course, love what Adrienne wrote. Thank you. That's what would be my highest aspiration, mm-hmm. You know, if that could happen.
I know that when you first started writing, you had talked about your writing process being different and your poems being more narrative. So could you tell us a little bit about how you moved to sort of a more spare, more imagistic poem, and maybe why? I don't know if that's possible, but
I don't really know how that happened. You know, as far as I remember, and I'd have to look back at the books, but I remember feeling as if I was kind of following people whose work I very much liked when I was writing those first poems, the poems that got into the first book. And then the second book that I wrote was more sort of, the poems were shorter and more I don't know the right word for it, but I would say more lyrical, mm-hmm. If we could just say that. But I don't know why or what happened exactly, except that maybe the way you do as you get a little older, you get a little more free of your influences and become more listening to yourself somehow. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a sense of the seen and unseen, the visible and invisible world, and it seems that maybe some readers may not see what you're sort of allowing us to see or alluding to. And how do you feel about that as a writer, that, you know, it takes a real, I think, intuitive and good reader to sort of see what you're up to? And
yeah, that might be true. And I was thinking, actually, as you were speaking, that maybe I was more thinking of a reader when I was writing that first book, and more trying to draw a map. And I maybe got a little bit of confidence through having one book out, and maybe began to not feel that I would need to do that as much or want to do that. I certainly didn't want to do it, but I might not need to do it quite as much. Maybe I had a little ground under me with having one book, you mm-hmm. know, and some people like my work, you know. And I guess I think of this with students, because this question often comes up of who do you write for? And it's often answered by very many great people. But I feel that I write for the poem and for my own self hearing it, you know, and not in a selfish way, but really to get down what I hear. And that's my responsibility. And that's what I say to my students. But because they don't always believe me. But that's what I feel, is that our responsibility is to put down what we hear. And then the world can make what it can of it, you know. And I don't mean in a careless way or in an uncaring way at all, but I just think that's enough of a job.
Sure.
You know, and it's not our responsibility then to make the next step.
Right. You know. Okay, can you read some more?
Sure. This is For a Woman Dead at 30, which I had written actually in my first book a poem called For a Woman Dead at 30, and then this is a second poem with that title. So it says For a Woman Dead at 32. But that was a long time ago in 1964, I think, that I wrote the first one, and it was about Sylvia Plath, who died at that time. She was just maybe a year older than me, and I felt her death very much. Well, I didn't know her work when she actually died, but after I began to know her work the year after, I felt very, of course, like everyone, very sad that she had died so young, because she was so gifted. And I've had a lot of feeling for her, I think, emblematically as a woman poet of my own time, when it wasn't, it's not easy now, but it was hard, I think. So this is for her. And I didn't want to say for Sylvia Plath, although I'm saying it now, but I didn't want to say that in print so much because it was I didn't want to be exploitative of her and all the attention around her and Ted Hughes and so forth. But I don't for some reason mind saying it now, reading it. It goes like this. In memory, you go through that door and go through that door and go through that door. Cold, dark, and then the way the sky is lightest over water. This world lightened as your words opened into their third star darkness. Now, this one is called Little Map. The white pine, the deer coming closer, the ant in my bowl. Where did she go when I brushed her out? The candle, where does it go? Our brush with each other, two animal souls without cave, image, or word. This is one I like because it's called Happiness, and all my poems are sad, so I wrote one called Happiness. Remember our happiness, under us, happiness, under the city, under our father's graves, happiness, under this world, under the gospel of the evangelist John. This is the happiness he leaned his head against. So now I'll read some from the second half of that book. The second half of The Cradle of the Real Life is called Her Lost Book. And I'll just read from a sort of a sequence at the beginning of that second half of that book. This first poem is called Embryo. Still mermaid, inside, her words only half gathered, her head still floating, listening to the real life. If I can, just go back for a minute. I forgot to read this epigraph that I have to the whole book from Martin Buber, which refers to the cradle of the real life. So long as the heaven of thou is spread out over me, the winds of causality cower at my heels, and the whirlpool of fate stays its course. No deception penetrates here. Here is the cradle of the real life. So that cradle is what this mermaid was listening to, listening to the real life. The next one is called The Women's Prison. I didn't teach in a women's prison myself, but I had friends who did, and they said that sometimes the women couldn't come to their class because they were teaching writing, because they were at another class, which was beauty care, so that they would learn to have a trade when they got out of prison. They could work in a beauty salon. The women in the prison are combing mannequins' heads of hair for beauty care. It's cold in there, a prison necklace of noose and lies. This bodily tool of governments, the toothpit, the grave.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jean Valentine, reading from her book, The Cradle of the Real Life. Since you sort of brought it up, I wanted to ask you about the difficulty of writing at that time. You attended Radcliffe was in the 60s? 50s. And
I graduated in 56.
Wow. And, I mean, that was right when the women's movement was forming, I would imagine.
Well, it was forming in some people's minds, but it really wasn't out there yet.
Wasn't out there, I mean, until the 60s. But it was a time when many, not too many women were pursuing the study of poetry, I would imagine, in universities. And can you talk about the challenge of writing at that time as a woman and studying at that time?
Yeah. Adrienne Rich had gone through Radcliffe and graduated in 51, and she had had a Yale series book published while she was an undergraduate. So she was a great light going ahead. And there were other poets in the world, like Elizabeth Bishop, Marianne Moore, but not many. And there were others who I didn't know about, like certainly Maxine Cumin had gone through Radcliffe, I think before Adrienne, I'm not sure, maybe after. And there was Muriel Rukeyser, but I hadn't always heard of them. I'd heard of the most famous ones. But all the teaching, almost all the teaching, I'd say all the teaching, might as well say, was done by women, by men, excuse me. And the women at Radcliffe got a first-rate education in the sense of the classes, but Harvard's, but we didn't get the kind of chance to know the professors often that the men got. And We were very second-class citizens. There's no doubt about that. And Harvard is a very, and was before my time, really not strong on the arts. It may be now, I think, better. But I talked to Stanley Kunitz, who went through there, I guess, in the 20s. I'm not sure. But he said you had to go out in the street to find any poetry, even in his day. So
yeah.
It wasn't, for men or women, strong on the arts. It wasn't strong for women. And, you know, you sort of do need models, I think. So I'm happier with the way things are now.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of women writers around. There were always women fiction writers, but poets were very thin on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Very few.
And I imagine the books that you read were probably by men also.
Oh, all of them.
Yeah,
for instance, I mean, they taught, there were men they didn't teach too, but they taught no women.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't think there was a woman poet being taught. They didn't teach Dickinson.
Mm-hmm.
No.
So what?
I don't even remember in fiction classes being taught women, but that could be different. But mm-hmm. I didn't have any.
So what enabled you to?
Very big on Robert Frost and you know, people. It was hard to relate to.
Yeah.
Although they were good, but you know.
Right. Your experience certainly wasn't mirrored in those books. But
no.
What enabled you to continue or to imagine that, well, I can do this. I don't see anyone except Adrienne and
Well, I didn't
Jane
know
Cooper.
Her, and she hadn't yet, at that time, written the work that we know her for. She had written Change of World, and she was probably working at that time on Diamond Cutter. But really, she didn't get to it till the third book, which was pretty good to get to it at all. But, you know, she
right.
didn't really, that was... 1958, I think, that she wrote Snapshot of a Daughter-in-Law that really was getting to it, and that was wonderful. But at that time, you couldn't find much. I couldn't, at any rate. But see, I didn't like Dickinson at that time. I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
It was only in 54, I think, that they brought out the Dickinson the way she wrote it. And I hadn't seen that yet, even though I could have in that time. But I thought she was coy and girlish, and I didn't like her.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me years to realize what a light she was, and that would have helped, but I couldn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I had a teacher who was encouraging in 1954, very encouraging, and I thought he was a brilliant writer and a brilliant soul. So, you know, when he kind of put his hand on my head, I felt, well, I can do this. And that was a turning point because I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think it wasn't that so much as the fact that there was nothing else I could do, nothing else I had any kind of handiness at. And even early in my life, I felt like this was a connection to myself and to the world that I needed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was that more than anybody else putting... you know, giving me a blessing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're glad you kept doing it.
Thank you.
Can you read some more poems? I know you have one brand new poem you wanted to read also.
Yeah, I do. This is called Prison, and it's about a guy named Ray Matterson who's given me permission to publish this, so I guess he wouldn't mind if I read it on the radio. It's really about his life. He was in prison, and he started doing embroidered pictures. In this poem, I have it be poems, but in his case, it was beautiful pictures. He became known as an outsider artist, and now he's out of prison and working with his art and working with young people. But what he did was he traded cigarettes for socks from the other prisoners and took the thread out of the socks and embroidered these little pictures, 2 inches by 2 inches, tiny little pictures. So it's called Prison, and I just tell that story. I will trade what? Cigarettes for their socks, for threads, to embroider little poems for you, 2 inches by 2 inches. I will trade what? whole days when I was free, red shadow on the inside of my skull, for socks, for threads. So that's for Ray Matterson. I could read some more from my own book. This is called In the Public Library. In the public library, a woman is reading a factory story. Several people listening. She gets to the fire, the noise, to the locked doors, the death room. The librarian says she has to stop. It's time for him to close. He closes. That was, I should say at the beginning, before I read that, but that was about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. I was thinking about that. I'm thinking about repression in general by officials and by employers and by all kinds of people who imprison us in various ways. Okay, I'll do a couple more. This is called Reading the Mandelstams. This is about the poet, the Russian poet Mandelstam, and his wife, Nadezhda, who kept his poems, didn't translate them, but kept them. Snow falling the sixth night on the stone house full of silence. Why can't they drive you both now, tonight, up to the house, light up the house? Lines of ice in the night window. Notes. He says to me in Ireland, is the name of this poem. It's the first line of the poem. He says to me, in Ireland, you've fallen into your destiny. He says, the teaching and giving readings, night and day, keep him from the void. I say, but you write about the void. I say, all these women, your mother, two wives, a lover, have died miserably. And you have lived to write about it, your history of the world. Or leave it out. But I want those women's lives, rage, constraints, the poems they burned in their chimney throats, the history of the world without words, more than your silver or your gold art. And this is one called What God Said. And it has my words for one stanza, and then it has what God said as quoted by St. Mechtilde of Magdeburg as the second stanza. What God said. After she died, her son destroyed her paintings. Incinerator flames. Quote, she wouldn't want anyone to see this stuff. Unquote. Then killed himself. And here God comes in. Do not fear your death, for when it arrives, I will draw my breath, and your soul will come to me like a needle to a magnet.
It's the poetry of Jean Valentine. She's reading from her book, The Cradle of the Real World. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You're listening to Prosody, WYAP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Sound engineers are Joel Grimes, Josh Pollack, and Ryan Patterson. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody. Radio made possible with member support, 91.3 WYEP.